All right. Okay, so for the Hansard record, would you please state your full names and the capacity in which you appear before the committee today? And if other people join the table to contribute before they make their contribution, if they, again, they would just identify themselves and what their position is before they make their contribution. So we'll start with you, Mr. Garrels.
Michael Garrels is my name. I'm the committee chair.
No worries. And then?
Yeah, Don Sager. I'm a member of the committee.
Yep. All right. You'll just have to leave that so we can see who you are.
I was going to sit back with the others.
Oh, all right then. Sorry. Mr. Miles.
David Miles, member of the committee.
Thank you.
Kevin Fuller, just a member.
All right.
Daniel Kennedy, a member of the consultative committee.
All right. And Mrs. Garrels?
Lee Garrels, member of the consultative.
Thank you. All right, Mr. Garrels.
I guess I'll start. Well, what I'd like to do is just some of the points that have been raised here today. I'd just like to answer, working my way back from what I've heard, if I could.
Well, actually, well, you probably can if you insist. I would like, before you get to that, to just explain what the committee is, what it does, how you formed it, and why. Just so we've got a good background and understanding of how you came to be, and then we'll go into some of that detail, if that's all right.
Right. The initial advocating was from myself. How it came about was, in my son's case, I felt the company was using the Coroner's Act to delay an inquest by using the court's delaying tactics. So I got in the media, made a lot of noise about it, and what happened was I had so many families, not just from Queensland but around the country, and unfortunately I didn't keep all their names and contact details, that rang me to say, you think the right thing's happening, you're just waking up to it, it's not, you know, and all these different things were thrown at me, and I thought, my God. I'd been in contact with Dan Kennedy by this time, I think, and I talked to him quite a bit, and I thought, you know, I'd had to go to ministers, I'd had to go to regulators, trying to get to a minister, trying to get a reply from a minister, you know. Basically, you would have to say, well, look, if you like, I will bring my spag, I will camp out the front of your office and I will stay there till you talk to me, right? Now, in the position our family was in, it's the last thing you need. And what I noticed was that all lobby groups seem to be able to wander into a minister's office at will to discuss whatever problem they may have. That's what got me to a committee of affected families. And I thought, well, my thinking at the time, before the others come on board, was that it should not be coloured by any side, union or lobby groups or anything else. It has to be just affected families, because everyone I had talked to had a very logical approach. And I can say, in all honesty, and I think all these people know exactly what I'm talking about, no one, whether it be a detective, a regulator, I don't care who you are, does not think more about what's happened and why it's happened than what we do. But our expertise is never asked for. We're not even allowed, really, to put it forward. We're told to, we don't really know what's going on, just sit down, settle down, and we've got this. And quite often that's not been the case. So
now you provide advice to affected families about working through the system?
Yeah, a lot of the people you've talked to today that aren't committee members, we've dealt with.
And obviously self-counselling with each other about your experiences.
We have a closed Facebook group that Lee's the administrator of.
Right.
Only affected family members are allowed on that. Mm-hmm. And that's where we can give one another support. We might meet up for a coffee here or there. Mm. Advice, you know, that people are too frightened to ask for off anyone else, because they don't know. You've got to explain yourself to everyone all the time in this. Well, amongst us, we don't have to explain ourselves at all. We
just
can just...
It becomes exhausting, doesn't it?
It does. It does, very much so. So I think I I can only vouch for myself, but it's been a big help
and support from government. And again, I know you want to tell us some things, but I just want to find out a few of these things first. Because I think we heard in Sydney some evidence around the fact that jurisdictions are actually getting better, and there's now some booklets being published about, well, what happens when this happens? How do you actually start to engage in the system? And no one was suggesting that that's perfect by any means. But I'm just wondering, do you get support from outside some jurisdictions who are now feeding into you to say, well, this would be a good tool for you to use with your group? Or
no, well, more we probably engage with groups. We ask different groups for involvement. Some are quite happy to do that, others are not interested. About that booklet you're talking about, I think you might find that was, I think, driven predominantly from Queensland, and that was directly all these people on the committee that came up with how best to try and do it, because, again, it's very individual. Mm. But probably we have a better idea than someone who has not suffered.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Oh, well, once you've had the experience, you know what to look for and what worked and certainly what didn't work.
Yeah.
All right, well, thank you. So unless there's any questions on that, the structure of... Well, I don't think we need to go into the actual structure of the committee. I think...
It's an evolving thing. Yeah.
Can I ask one question?
Yes, of course.
I think I asked earlier in the day, and it probably wasn't the right time to ask. Perhaps, Mr. Garrels, you could do it, or I'm not sure any of you, I suppose, could probably answer it well. Can you explain to our committee the range of support services that are offered by the group and that might be models, I suppose, for the other states?
Anyone want to answer or I answer? It's everything and anything. It may be for this person that they feel that this law is wrong and it needs to be amended or whatever else. So if that be the case, you know, if we all sit, we have a discussion and we talk to different people, probably in the regulator and outside, to get advice, and then we go, well, he's right, that does need to be amended. We will then help them try to get that amended, because that's important to them. And if nothing is done, that's destructive to them. So it could be anything.
So advice on law reform?
It can be helping getting that. It can be helping meeting a regulator and asking a question. It can be just someone to talk to that's been through similar. It's a whole range. I think Lee has more to add to it.
Sure.
Yeah. So with Craig, your support before pre-committee, like Michael took 3 months long service leave. He only had a brother who's a policeman and had to do it all himself to present Jason's. Now, with the committee that was identified, we have Caxton Legal Service, who's pro bono, who helps people put, you know, it helps families represent themselves through coronial inquests, because often they can't afford, you know, legal representation and haven't got that, only have a layman's knowledge. Counselling, as in my case, I had no counselling for 8 months, mainly because our regulator had an agreement with Queensland Health that there was counselling, and I kept being told, you know, I was on top of the list, and then it was got cut due to budget cuts, and then I had to go for a GP mental health plan, and then I was on a wait list for another 2 months waiting to see a psychologist. So in light of being in my own son's resuscitation and waiting 8 months, that was one of the first things we went and saw Minister Curtis about, simple things like counselling for families who are going through grief. It's quite isolating. People in the community don't know how to deal with it. They haven't got the tools to deal with it, so you need professional help. And so just simple things like coronial inquests, counselling, having good pathways, being systematic with families, you know, having the coronial liaison officers to have that communication and having a voice, I suppose, in asking questions. You know, the coronial liaison officers, they're having good support for the coronial liaison officers, because it would be quite a hard job dealing with grieving families, so they need expertise, they need training. But I suppose we've gone through a lot, like with the ESO, through legislation, through their training. We've asked, you know, why there's such big gaps in education, and specifically, I suppose, because a lot of us actually have cases where it's really highlighted that the electrician had a serious lack of training, like they didn't know how to do simple things like earth. So it comes back to roots of training education. And then, of course, look at other cases where maybe it's actually the safety culture at the top. So that's just, in short, some of the things. But there's been a lot of work that we've done that's been very good for families, and I think it'd be wonderful if other families in other states could have a committee like ours. It's very good for affected families.
A lot of the evidence this morning suggested that it would have been nice to have somebody reach out and offer some experience of dealing with this process in the immediate aftermath of getting terrible news like each of you have received. Does the committee try and do that in a proactive way when
I think it's time frames too. Like from looking at some of the submissions from other people, like some people weren't even notified. They saw it on the news. So I think there's a lot of work being done with the QPS and about notifying next of kin, and also if there's relatives, because the next of kin may not be the parents. So there's a lot of work around securing crime scenes. So there's a lot of work we actually have a network called SWIG, which is a network of industry as well as like QPS and ESO. So it's really good, and it's cross industry, and it's people networking to try the best for industry through regulation, through also helping, I suppose, affected families and anything else that comes up.
Okay, thank you.
That's what I mean. It's about every part of this, but when you say about people wanting to talk, it's not something you can go and chase someone for, if you know what I mean. Like, if you have a death in your family, or your husband, or one of your children, or whatever, I can't approach you. You need to approach me. So it's about getting that information to you that, here, you can go approach these people. They've been through this. They're willing to help you. It doesn't necessarily mean people will. And some people have a very high degree of suspicion. Like at the last workers' memorial, we always get hosted there. And we get, because this is how bad the system is, they never kept all the people that had lost someone in the industry. Historically, they didn't keep their names. That's the regulator. So the ones we did have emailed invites and said, look, this is a place for families to go. The union toned down and did an excellent job of remembering fallen workers. Those families that come along, they were really touched. They'd never been to anything like it. Then once they met some of the people on the committee, at first, in one particular family, they were very suspicious of me. And when I said, I'm not a government employee, I'm the chair of this committee, yes, but it's all affected families. We have all suffered in the way you have. Instant change. Because he said, I felt like I'd been flogged by government for years and nothing ever happened. You know, and that's the kind of support. And that's why it's really important that this be urged to be done in every state. Now, when we did it here, and I think it's in my submission, it was, we agreed, because we'd had a forum, we all got together. Some people aren't in the committee anymore, but, you know, some have moved on, so to speak. The thing we agreed on, that these state positions should not be paid positions, and because we didn't want anyone to ever point and say, well, someone's getting something out of this, so to speak, because unfortunately there are people that would do that, point that out or think that way. But now, being the first person to do it, I've got to tell you, it is turning into a workload, and there is still... I have not been to an inquest to support the family there. I dealt with a man from England who flew over, him and his wife flew over for their inquest in Mackay. I would love to have gone to that, and to help them through that process, because that is the second worst week of your life. Your first week is, the first one is burying your loved one, the second one is an inquest if you have it. And I think it would be really beneficial to be able to do that. And that's why I'm asking for a federal council that helps with legislation or can at least have things bounced off us at a federal level. I think we're very underutilised at the moment, but I think the regulators are starting to learn that we may be of a benefit. Then also to chase up on issues for families as well, and to be able to go do that networking that it's become important to me. I think everyone else would agree it's been important to them. It's helped a lot. That's...
Well, thank you. Well, I'm let me assure you, you know, these things have been exercising our minds. The inquiry's only started. This is only the second hearing, and we've got a little way to go. And but certainly, we're already turning our minds to ways we can formalise some of those communications, I think, and ensure that you actually have status in a process. But you know, we'll continue to develop those, and I'm sure before we get to any recommendations, we'll be communicating with some of you guys again, just to make sure that whatever we recommend is actually useful to you. So I'll hand back to you now, Mr. Garrels, and you can go back to where you wanted to start.
Right, yeah. These are some of the paperwork on different organisations we've approached and the responses we've got, if it's a benefit to you. I just made a few points as we're going along, and you were talking, Senator Stoker, you were talking about the expertise needed for investigations. We as a committee went to the Queensland Police here. I think I talked about it this morning, and we do have an understanding from the Queensland Police that experienced detectives will be the first people involved, not just any uniformed copper that doesn't have experience. But experienced detectives will be involved, and they will stay involved until they are sure that deceptive behaviour is not involved, because that's what they're experts at. Now, they will liaise with experts that are there on the particular tasks, the thing. So, you know, and that's about intent. So I think that's important to go with this legislation, I really do, and I do think that the legislation is needed. Now,
when you say intent, you mean establishing whether or not the incident was the product of negligence, recklessness,
oversight, whatever
or
it may
intention.
Be. That's right.
Okay.
Was it
yep.
profit?
You know, blah, blah, blah.
Yep. Now, in business, you asked about levelling the playing field. Well, in all honesty, it's enforcement. If you drive people that are bad at business, that want to risk people's lives, you have ramifications that drive them out of business. You are making it better for the better businessmen, because they then do not have to compete against this person who is going to undercut them at every opportunity and use safety to do that. So, you know, and that's a lay down as air. I can't see how it's not.
Except the situation that was identified by Mrs. Newport, where she identified that in her son's situation, the need to report particular incidents meant they developed a culture of hiding incidents rather than truly holding people accountable for it. So, look, you may well be right, but I do think there's a tension between the two.
If that was investigated properly, and I can tell you, because I was involved in Mrs. Newport's case,
right.
I can tell you when they redid the investigation, they still could not get from that company their LTI system. They would not give it to them. This is in a death. In investigation, they refused...
Well, workplace health and safety have the right to
demand
that information.
You would think.
Well,
I don't know, but correct me if I'm wrong, Jen, they said that they couldn't get that information, didn't they?
I don't know. They've never given it to us. No.
That's right. And that's what they told us at the time when we went back for that. So had they have investigated that and found out that, yes, OK, they are using the LTI system, well, then you can get to who decided that we will use the LTI system in this way and prosecute them. And do you think the next company would do it then? No, they won't, because, oh, shit, I end up in jail if I foster this kind of behaviour. It's not change the system to reward behaviour.
I understand what you're saying. It just seems to me that the critical point here is the resourcing and education of quality investigators, because that's what would have flushed that out.
Yep.
An investigator who knew what they were doing would have known they had the power to request that information, would have had enough of their mind across the detail to follow that up.
The want to do it. And back to that, because we talk about a cost involved in this. We've got to use a pay society. All of us, toll roads, bloody tax on every bloody thing under the sun, and that's fine.
No, it's not.
But if you're a user pay and you are guilty, then you should pay for everything. So if you've caused the ambulance to respond, you pay for the ambulance. If you've caused an investigation, you pay for that investigation. If you've caused a prosecution, you pay for the prosecution. The whole lot of it. Because it's your responsibility that all of that happened. So why should you not have to pay for it? And there's your costs. There's your costs covered. Now we can start educating all our investigators and everything properly and make sure we have specialists in those fields that do a really good job, because we're making sure that the people are guilty of doing it are paying for it. Yep. And that should be the case.
I think your argument's pretty compelling. And I'm being devil's advocate here just to make sure we're testing this as best we can. The counter-argument is that others have said that when they're dealing with a criminal prosecution, a defendant throws everything and the kitchen sink at defence, and that prejudices the prosecution, that makes it harder for the state to do the job well. Wouldn't adding that additional consequence...
It'll make them fight harder or fold sooner.
I would have thought so.
But if they fight harder and they lose, they pay more.
All right, so okay. So what I'm going to suggest now is that over every point, we won't be able to have a discussion debate. or any debate over it because we will never get to the end. So what we'll do is some of the things, just so everyone understands the process. There's not always the opportunity, and just because it's said and not disputed doesn't necessarily mean you've got, agreement across the board.
Yeah,
we'll have an opportunity to come back and ask questions, and some key things may be tested or debated a little, but we'll have to do it that way rather than incident by incident. So okay. Keep going, Mr. Garrels.
Rightio. I've heard a little bit of talk about from the master electricians in Victoria about privatising the inspections or something or other. Government should never abdicate their responsibilities when it comes to this. I just feel that's going down the wrong path. That's government's responsibility, is to make sure things happen in the right way. Businesses is to make a profit. And the two don't mix. When they were talking about casualisation, I do actually work in mining, and I can tell you on the site I work on, and the site's immediate all around, and it's in the Bowen Basin. We've gone from 70% permanent, 30% casual, to the exact opposite. 30% are now casual. Now, the offshoot of this is black lung has reappeared, and I have seen firsthand the levels of dust are through the roof, because in the old days when they were all company workers, people pulled things up. They said, right, I'm pulling this truck up till you water this circuit because this dust is ridiculous. Now they call up and they say, look, can we get a water cart? Yeah, we'll get one to you. Someone else rings in, complains, and they say, oh, well, just lock it down a gear and keep going. And because they're casual, if they pull over or they make a habit of pulling over because of that, all of a sudden they're not needed the next day. So I'm really sorry, but I've seen it firsthand, and I've seen the difference over the last decade of what that's meant. And I really believe, and I fear... and I have raised it with the regulator here in Queensland. I fear for all the young people that are in the industry, because 10 to 15 years' time, they're going to have young families, and some of them will be turning up with silicosis and black lung if we don't address it. And we need to address it quickly. It can't be a slow process, you know. It's that's just something I wanted to throw up to you. with the ABCC, and it's had a lot of mentions. What I'd like to know is, it has special powers. Am I right? Because of the laws in there?
Very special powers. Mm.
Why was it never included to investigate work deaths? Because with their special powers, they could get to the bottom of things a lot quicker.
I know they were instituted to do that, Mr. Garrels.
Hi.
Anyway, look.
But that's just
let's just steer away from.
Well,
from
no, I'm just raising.
Yeah, no, fair enough.
You and, people are the only opportunity I get to do this.
No, and it's fair enough. But it's a highly contentious political issue.
Well, I'm not here to be contentious.
No, I know you're not. I know you're not, and that's why we could spend all day if we open that door talking about that. And I suggest let's not. Let's move on to the next one.
And when we went on it, we were talking earlier about the expectations in the courts. The one thing that never comes up is the family's expectation. And I think the families need to have a say in that process, where it should go once all the facts are unearthed. You know, I think the family should have a say in where it should go. They should be as important as anyone in that system. Rightio. I'll leave it to the others now. Probably said enough.
There was talk earlier on today about safety switches and RCDs that, and particularly from the last two guys sitting in these chairs as well, everybody across the country talks that the safety switches were legislated in 92, and houses built since 92 have all safety switches on all circuits. Stuff I've read in the last few weeks has clearly shown that all new houses need at least one safety switch on one circuit. I think that's hot water. But none of it clearly says that every house being built since 92 has every single circuit covered. And even if it does, I go back to what I said this morning as well. It's not in the ceiling space. It's not in the underground space if there's a two-level home and so on. So there's quite a lot that still needs to be done to make sure that Australians understand in each state where they're up to with safety switches. Because if someone moves from Brisbane to Canberra or Canberra to somewhere else, is the same level of commitment by the electrical safety offices and the installers the same? Because people will get blindfolded based on the information they were either brought up with or had in their own previous home. And did I hear correctly this afternoon where the two electrical guys were talking that there's no electrical health and safety qualification to be a business license holder?
So they're representing, they're one of the employer organisations within the electrical industry. You call them electrical guys, it's very generous. They weren't, I'm the electrical guy. they made the point, you need to be an electrician, a licensed electrician, but to actually work in business as a contractor, you also need an electrical contractor's licence, which has some business elements to it as well.
So if they're a licensed electrician, they can employ people straight out of school or off the street. Who then trains those people to do the correct thing with electricity?
Yes. All right. Well, I'm supposed to be asking you questions, but we'll let this one go. And I may be a little bit out of date, but there's two ways an electrician can employ someone and train someone, and that is either through an apprenticeship or they can be a trades assistant, but the type of work that they can do is actually very restricted. It's not technically electrical work. It's incidental to the electrical work. So it may be carrying cables and unrolling cables and doing things like that, but it isn't actually the installation of electrical work. That's only done through an apprenticeship.
Senator Marshall, the electrician, I'm quite happy that you know all those things. However, do all the electricians, and how do we know that all the electricians who are just about going into business and employing those people do the right thing?
Yes, well, I do despair. And with the I don't want to sound like, I guess, my father used to sound to me, but it ain't what it used to be.
No. In lots of industries.
Yes. Mm.
There's one other one I wanted to ask you, but I can't think of it for a minute, so I'll pass. Yes.
All right, Mr. Garrels, back to you. Oh, no, sorry, Mr. Myers.
I apologise, but I can't.
Yes, you can.
Pass those.
And
I'm the most fortunate member of this committee, because I'm not dead, basically. But I have been injured at work, and I have been probably close to that number of times. I've got an awful lot to say, but I'm not going to do it today. So I've been told keep the mouth shut, so I will. So basically, there's just two things that I've read through some of the submissions, including Mr. Garrell's and the one for the Queensland Ombudsman. And I've also experienced issues myself following workplace incidents in getting information that you should be able to get from company safety information. So there's a couple of things I've thought of here. There's a very easy way to make sure that all information related to safety and maintenance is available to the regulator at all times, and that nobody can actually turn around and say, hang on, this is confidential information, it's commercially sensitive, etc., etc. All you do is you say, okay, you keep all this information anyway. You have to keep it by law. You have to maintain your plant. You have to show this. You have to have your safe worth, make statements, all that sort of stuff. You keep copies of that on a database, and a database that is available to the industry regulator. So there's no extra cost to business. It's just the same information in one database. You then make it, if you like, not illegal, obviously, but to that effect that they cannot put commercially sensitive information in that database. You then put a provision that, just in the same way that if you're in a court and you inadvertently disclose information that was your legal privilege between yourself and your lawyer, say you're overheard or whatever, it's lost through inadvertent disclosure. It's the same thing. If they put it in the database, tough, you've lost it. Then you also time and date stamp everything that goes on there so it can't be deleted. So you can't get a situation, which I've experienced, is where you get a number of versions of the same report, and each report is different. Different information is disclosed, and they basically change the story to try and cover up liability. So if then what you could do is you could actually have it disclosable to the regulator 4 times a year. Now, that sounds expensive, but it's not, because you're talking here about a $100 portable hard drive. You put it on that, give it to the regulator, they download it, you give it back. The regulator doesn't even have to look at it. It's just there so that if a major incident happens 2 years later, they can't say, oh, look, we've done all this for 2 years. It's all there, including, you know, what they've spent on doing this and everything else. So there's no, I've had that as well, where it appears that records after the event, there's a number of pieces of plant, everything's been amalgamated, and it looks like it's been maintained the hell out of the thing. Well, that wasn't the case. Anyway, we won't go on to that. But what this also does is it gives you the opportunity to do what the, particularly in mining, they can't do at the moment. I've been told it's between 43 and 46 mines inspectors for the whole of Queensland, which is a ridiculously small number. And I also have never seen workplace health and safety or a mine inspector on any site. Even after 2 workplace incidents, I didn't speak to one. Injuries, sorry. So they can't get out anywhere. But what they can do is, if they've got this information, they can just routinely pick one to order, and they can pick up these things before they happen, because that's the key. I mean, you'll obviously know about the pyramid. If you, for every death, you've got whatever it is, 25 serious injuries, you know, 100 injuries, etc., etc. If you can stop the bottom, you can stop the top. So that was the first one, and there's a little bit more in there. I've also given some examples of my own experience, which I'm not going to say here, because mainly it's on Hansard. And also, Mr. Garrell's came up with a rather good idea that I assume you all know what an open cut examiner is. Do you? No.
Well, we're going to say yes, but why don't you remind us?
Okay. Basically, so imagine you've got a mine, an open pit, and basically he's the guy who is effectively responsible for everything, for production, for safety, everything else. And he's appointed, now I may not be quite correct on this, he is appointed by being put forward to selection from, I think you get somebody from the DNRM, the mines inspectorate that is, you get somebody from the union, you get somebody from maybe the employers, I'm not sure, and other bodies. So they, it looks like, on the face of it, okay, this guy is going to be suitable for the job as to, in terms of safety and everything else, but the trouble is there's a lot of people who want that job, and it's the job everybody on a mine site who wants to go somewhere wants, and once they get that position, they want to keep it. So there is a temptation, and again, I put some instances there, one of which is provable, where an OC may have compromised their position, possibly to retain it and protect their position. So it does happen. It's known to happen, and I've had experience of it. So basically, what you need to do, I think, is give them a security of tenure, so they're not basically, in the same way as a judge, except for not till they're 70, So they can't be tempted to put production and keeping their next, you know, the next year's good pay in check. Basically, their focus has to be primarily safety and thereafter production, etc. And what you can do there is if you give them 5 years and then you say you cannot have a second term in this mine, you can go somewhere else, or there could be other positions related to safety or mine management that you could take from there, but you cannot have this same position. What you then also could get is you could get different OCEs from different mines going to other mine sites. Now, from my experience of working in mine sites, some of them try to be very good. They don't always get there, but they try to be very good. Others, you can tell the same stuff has been going on probably for decades, and it's the same people. So what you need to do is transfer Miles, these people between.
Can I say, you know, I really appreciate the amount of effort and thought you've put into this,
much.
But... That sort of detail is going far beyond what this committee's going to be able to deal with.
Okay.
But look, I do thank you. And
It's there on paper if you want it.
No, that's right. And it's good that people are actually thinking about remedies to problems and how we may deal with these things. Can I just say, look, I think, again, as I said, it's fairly early days in the inquiry, but one of the things... we will do is talk to some regulators, maybe not every jurisdiction, but some, about their powers and their training, their ability, their confidence to enforce the laws, because I think Senator Stoker is quite right. The example used before is that the regulator would have the power to go in and have any documents and require any documents that they think they need for an investigation. Now, it may be that the regulator is not confident to actually ask for some of these things, and there could be a whole range of reasons for that. It may be that people have pushed back and simply said no, and that the regulator is not confident about pursuing that to the next step. But these are things we probably do need to ask the regulators, because I think, you know, all of you have sat here all day, and all of you have experienced what you consider to be very poor investigations, and it looks like, you know, this is fundamental. I'm sure the regulators and the investigators don't want to be poor regulators and investigators, so we need to look at what they need to make that better, and I think that's a key component. Yes, Mr.
Can I make one more point? It's just that the in my experience, what the regulators actually do is they give the mine document production notices, and it's up to the mine to give them what they want. So
yes, we're actually we're having that same experience with another inquiry, which we also have running at the moment with the offshore petroleum regulator,
I'll just say, if I've got information that's not disclosed to the mine regulator, that's ridiculous.
Yes, I, you know? Yes. All is not as it should be in this space. We're already at that point. Don't worry about that. All is not as it should be. Mr. Fuller.
I remembered my third one.
Good.
I am lucky, yeah. Dr. John Martin from the QCU educated us that there's only been three Category 1 incidents in the last 6 years. They were all long-term cases. It takes a long time, by the look of that, for those sorts of cases to come to the top. So I just don't want any of us walking away thinking there's only been three serious incidents in the last 6 years, because they were probably in the last 12 years, not the last six, because it takes such a long time for those things to click in.
Yes.
So we don't want people fudging the numbers, basically, is where I'm coming from.
Now, Mr. Garrels, one of the other areas which I'm particularly concerned about and is part of the terms of reference is jurisdictional problems. And we know there's some examples about depending on where companies have been registered and depending on where the accident happened and investigators being able to cross borders and things like that. Do you have much, if anything, and if you don't, that's fine, do you have much to talk to us about that matter?
Well, again, I think if directors for those companies and are responsible, then I think you might get a better result in cross-jurisdictional issues because, again, the company entity is where all this hiding seems to go on and directors never seem to be held responsible. They get the payout if there's a bonus coming because the company's performed or whatever else, but any of the penalties don't seem to go their way. So I think along those lines, you need to direct more towards the individual rather than the entity. And that's probably a big problem is, as I said earlier, we keep prosecuting the car and forgetting about the driver. So to me, that's quite a big problem. I think Deb wanted to raise something with you.
Just a couple of quick points. We live in regional North Queensland, so we're forever advocating for affected families because we're feeling the isolation on a daily basis. Like, all decisions are generally made in Brisbane for us. So for us to have had a face-to-face, that means we have got on a plane, flown down here, we've used sick leave, vacation leave, long service leave, no pay. That's a high cost. And for many families, that cost is way too high. They just can't do it. So, and that's also leaving your support group behind too. So that's one of the driving forces we are in this committee for also. Like, I mean, we're obviously wanting to change to make workplaces safer, but we're here to say, don't forget there's regional people. And that doesn't matter which state someone is living in, there's regional people. It may also mean that you live 2 hours south, east, well not east, but south or west of Brisbane. You're quite isolated if you haven't got the means to get back to where the decisions are made. And we have found the only way that we've got a lot of our answers ourselves is by coming here to Brisbane, knocking on doors, finding the right door. But that takes a number of times. So that's that financial burden. And the other, we included a ESO newsletter attachment on our submission. And part of that, the Electrical Safety Office said that we could people could request the ESO to commence a prosecution if they believed it was a Category 1 or 2 within 6 to 12 months. There is no way a family is ready to go down that line between 6 and 12 months, and as we've already had said, a lot of us have said, we thought the investigation was already going along fine. And
just run that by me again. So this is the Department of Electrical Safety or whatever it's called, but so it's, who's the electrical inspector?
Yeah, so that's in part of the appendix on our submission, and it's in there to say that people can request that the Electrical Safety Office commence a prosecution if they believe a Category 1 or 2 offence of electrical safety laws has occurred and a prosecution hasn't commenced between 6 and 12 months of the offence occurring. Now, if I'm right, that came out in 2016. I have read it in other in the Safety Act from previous issues.
Statutes. Yeah. All right. Well, it'd be interesting.
Yeah.
We'll write to this body and actually find out what they mean by that.
We are people, and there's no way.
Yeah.
And we're the most invested in the whole process, and there's no way would we even be contemplating thinking we're going to prosecute because we can't even get our heads around the fact that for us our son had died, let alone go down
that's again why I come back to a committee is there's statute of limitations that revolve around all kinds of things in this. that people don't understand and are not ready to deal with. They're not ready to deal with it till they're ready to deal with it. Mm. And that takes years to get your head into that space.
But having said that, and I don't want to, you know, I think that's right, but nonetheless, the wheels and the machinery of government must start to proceed straight away.
No, that's and, fine. But yeah. But what I'm talking about is like the statute that says 6 to 12 months.
Yeah.
Well, generally people don't know. If people don't get involved straight away, they don't know the particulars of their case. No. And if they trust the system's going well, they may go to an inquest, sit in the back of the inquest, and then go, oh, my God,
you didn't
they
know
did
that.
That. Yeah. We didn't know that.
And it's very crushing.
And then when they yeah. look at statutes for civil, they look at statutes like this, all these things, it's devastating because all of a sudden you go, Jesus, I could have done something, but I can't anymore.
Well, cutting to the chase, what concerns me about that really is that you'd think if there was enough grounds for a prosecution, the regulator will prosecute. It should not be up to the family to make that request. Like, now, so I don't know why that's written the way it is, and we'll ask that question, but it does sound odd to me, that's all.
The unfortunate thing in that, for us going back a long time ago, if we hadn't gone to the regulator, if we hadn't gone on numerous occasions and talked with them about what we'd found out, I doubt they would have done anything in our son's case. Mm. And listening to people today, we're not the only one.
And there was a similar story in Sydney too, I must say. So have any senators got some more questions? And we'll try to wrap up in the next 10 minutes or so. Yes, Mr. Miles?
I actually suggested this. I'm sorry, I should have suggested it in committee, but I didn't. I'm just with a couple of members the other day. With these RCDs, there seems to be a problem with fitting them to retrospectively to houses, domestic properties. And Mr. Garrels has also said about the new smart meters, where they automatically basically take your meter reading, and that when they fit those, they should fit RCDs. I've got one better than that, much better. The other thing is that if you fit RCDs to old houses, the lighting circuits, they often trip them. So what I thought of the other day was you design these things once. It'll cost no different to manufacture them. You design the smart meters with the RCDs inbuilt. You've got three circuits, okay? The first one's your power sockets, which everybody seems to think are fine. You can just fit them up. The second one's lighting. That's there. And the third one has no RCD. So you put it in and you give them 5 years. You say, okay, in 5 years' time, that is sealed over, or 3 years or whatever it is. And you have to use this new circuit, so you've got this period of time. But in the meantime, if you have a fire, you're not covered for your insurance, you're not covered for liability, because we know that you've got substandard electricity. We're telling you should do it now, but if you can't afford to do that, you've got this period. And after that period from installation, you seal it off. And if it's all the one box, and you make it law that it's designed into all these new smart meters, every single one will have them. So that's it.
Trouble is, smart meters have been rolled out in their millions already. Yes, it's a very constructive thought.
Stop. Redesign them.
Yep.
You know?
Can I finish on just two things?
Yes, sorry.
I could, please. Okay, you might notice this signpost, and it's on the card you have there. Support, and you asked what the committee means. This is, to me, support, network amongst families, and that can't be underestimated. The prevention. The ability to highlight directly with those who govern the system is essential, and it is to your mental health when this happens. It is very essential. On justice, the death of someone cannot be worthless. And that's, again, ask any of these people. Reform is the ability to secure future generations from suffering the same fate. That's what the committee, I think, means. If anyone else has anything on that, they can add that. One last question I want to ask, because I think we've got both sides of the major parties represented here today. Who's willing to give a commitment to the establishment of a committee such as ours in each state and territory of Australia? We seem to be the only group today here that are presenting a simple, cost-effective measure to improve support for people following a workplace fatality along with collaborative work with the government to develop preventative strategies to eliminate or reduce the number of fatal workplaces occurring in Australia. So you'll probably want to take them on notice, but I'm asking the question.
We've had it face-to-face with all of the people in the workplace health and safety arena tell us that the stuff that we're doing for them, or with them anyway, it's not, I'm not talking of other families, I'm talking of the system, they now understand a lot better what needs to be done, what the causes and actions and outcomes are, and they are more positive that they can now make better changes. And that's Queensland. But there's no point in Queensland doing that on its own and us sitting back on our laurels alone thinking, yes, we fixed everything. We as a committee, we're trying to fix as much as we can, as quickly as we can, so that we can rest.
And certainly these issues are in our minds, and you know, they do go to the terms of reference. And in case you didn't know, this inquiry was effectively established because of the lobbying of someone in your situation, Kay, behind you. Mm-hmm. And you know, I've spoken to Michael in the development of this, and it is very much about trying to get a situation where people are, you know, of course we want to avoid any injury or workplace death, but you know, if we're at that point, that there is a process for people to work through with some dignity and respect. So we might end it there. Thank you again very much for your contribution to this inquiry. It's been incredibly valuable to us. I'm sure we'll see some of you at least again before the conclusion of this inquiry.